I'm going to whisper some things to you now about Crunch chocolate bars. Because apparently this whispering thing is a thing that makes you feel things. It's saying something crunchy is coming in the candy wrapper language. Imagine your tongue hiking up those crispy, rocky ridges. Now, drumroll please.
Wow, that's good. Crunchy, munchy chocolate doesn't whisper.
Turn up the fun with Crunch.
This is your last chance to enter the Ohio Lottery's Fun Turns 50 promotion. Score $3,500 and two tickets to the epic party at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, where you could win part of another $400,000 in cash prizes. Enter the new 50th anniversary scratch-off or $50 worth of eligible non-winning $5 or $10 scratch-offs and My Lotto rewards through the Ohio Lottery app. Hurry up! The last entry deadline is May 13th. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
Hi, everyone, and thank you for tuning in to the 513th episode of the Hollywood Reporter's Awards Chatter podcast. I'm the host, Scott Feinberg, and my guest today is one of the most distinguished producers in the history of independent film, with credits including 1994's Go Fish, 1995's Kids, 1998's Happiness, 1999's Boys Don't Cry, 2004's A Dirty Shame, 2014's Still Alice, and 2020's Zola, plus every feature film directed by Todd Haynes, among them 1991's Poison, 1995's Safe, 1998's Velvet Goldmine, 2002's Far From Heaven, 2007's I'm Not There, 2015's Carol, 2017's Wonderstruck, 2019's Dark Waters, and 2021's The Velvet Underground. The co-founder and co-partner with Pamela Koffler of Killer Films and the queen of new queer cinema, Christine Vachon. Vachon also produced two of 2023's most acclaimed films, either or both of which, with a Best Picture Oscar nomination, could bring her Oscar recognition for the first time in her career. A24's Past Lives, the feature directorial debut of Celine Song, which tells the story of a young Korean immigrant living in New York who winds up at a bar with her childhood sweetheart from Korea and her husband from the Big Apple. And another Haynes-directed film, Netflix's May-December, which is about an actress spending time with a woman she is set to play in a film who years earlier was the center of scandal for having a relationship with a much younger man. Vachon has been described by The New Yorker as the doyen of independent producers, by The Los Angeles Times as the ultimate independent producer, and by Screen Daily as one of the independent film world's most influential producers. Meanwhile, indie producer, sales agent, talent manager, and entertainment lawyer John Sloss has described her as the most effective producer of films that are both commercial and intelligent. Indie exec Ted Hope has said, in a business filled with narcissistic, deceitful misanthropes, Christine is the antidote, a truthful voice driven by a pure passion for film. And indie producers representative John Pearson, the author of Spike, Mike, Slackers, and Dykes, a guided tour across a decade of American independent cinema, has said, if there is a pure spirit of independent film alive in this country, it's Christine Vachon. Vachon, I should note, is herself the author of two wonderful books, 1998's Shooting to Kill and 2006's A Killer Life, the latter of which she co-wrote with Austin Bunn and was recently chosen by a Blue Ribbon panel organized by The Hollywood Reporter as one of the 100 greatest film books of all time. In the former, though, she describes her work as follows. Quote, when I'm asked what producers do, I say, what don't they do? I develop scripts, I raise money, I put together budgets. I negotiate with stars willing to work for said generally meager budgets. I match directors with cinematographers, cinematographers with production designers with location managers. I make sure that a shoot is on schedule, on budget, on track. I hold hands, I stroke egos. I once had to bail an actor out of jail for gay bashing, no less. Close quote. In short, no matter what, Vachon makes sure that a film gets across the finish line in its best possible form. Over the course of our conversation at the offices of The Hollywood Reporter, the 61-year-old and I discussed her early ambition to become a director and why she shifted to producing after meeting Haynes. What caused the flurry of films in the early 1990s, a number of which she produced, that came to be described as new queer cinema? How she navigated challenges on the sets of films like Boys Don't Cry and Carol, and turned controversy to her advantage with films like Poison, Kids, and Happiness? what she thinks about the evaporation of the mid-range budget movie and the rise of streamers, why she keeps betting on first-time filmmakers like Song and collaborating with old friends like Haynes, plus much more. And so, without further ado, let's go to that conversation.
Christine, thank you so much for coming in and doing this. Great to see you. And on this podcast, we begin truly at the beginning. Can you share with our listeners where you were born and raised and what your folks did for a living?
I was born and raised in New York City on 119th Street and Riverside Drive near Columbia University. And my father was a photographer, and he worked for the FSA, which is the organization that was started in the 30s to document the Depression. Mm-hmm. So a lot of those black and white photographs that you equate with Walker Evans and Dorothea Lange, et cetera, those were the kinds of photographs he took. Oh. And they actually, Walker Evans actually taught him how to use a camera.
Amazing.
So he worked for Look magazine when I was growing up. Until Look folded, and took a lot of photographs of luminaries like Marilyn Monroe and Judy Garland and John F. Kennedy, et cetera.
Yeah.
He died when I was 13, and my mother immigrated from France when she was in her early 20s, met my father, who was considerably older than she was, and she earned a PhD in French literature at Columbia and taught French when I was growing up, and then eventually got a job at the United Nations running their entire French language program.
Wow.
So.
Now, were they movie buffs? Were they taking you to the movies as a kid, or what kind of movies were you consuming?
Well, one of the things that's great about growing up in New York City is, you know, I could walk to a movie theater. I could walk to several. I could walk to the Olympia on 106th Street, which was one of those, like, former beautiful theaters that had been sliced up into, you know, four theaters, your feet stuck to the floor. you could hear the other movie, you know, in the theater next door. But that was what we, you know, what we formerly called, you know, B-movie houses or second-run houses. And it was a dollar on Saturdays, and if we liked a movie, we would just stay and watch it again. Mm-hmm. Down the street from there was the Thalia, which I guess is still there. And, you know, my parents would take us often. My mother would take us to French movies. And they, you know, would take us to Chaplin films and Marx Brothers and things like that. And sometimes we would wander in just because the title sounded interesting. And there was, you know, my best friend when I was 10 and 11 years old was a guy named Paul Selig. And we decided one day that we wanted to see a horror film. And, you know, this is when kids were very free range. So we were actually wandering around Times Square, and we saw on a marquee the title Cries and Whispers. And we thought, well, that sounds scary.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was, but not the way we thought it was going to be. Oh, so, wow. So that was really, you know, being able to kind of control our own movie destiny was pretty great.
So eventually you go off to Brown.
Yep.
And I wondered, at the time you were starting there, what did you think you might do with your life at that point?
I mean, that's an interesting question, because I think now young folks are really, they really want to know, like, as they enter college, what the end result is going to be so that they can work towards it.
Right.
And I think I still had enough of a foot in the hippie, you know, the hippie 60s. I went to Brown in the early 80s that I just, you know, I was kind of, let's see what happens. Now, there was Brown infamously famously had a semiotics department.
Yes.
Which, you know, that's what Todd studied. It's what I studied. It's what it's where film production was located. Mm-hmm. So if you wanted to pick up a camera and tell a story, you had to take a lot of semiotics classes first, which may have had a, you know,
boosted the participation.
I don't know. It might have dampened the, you know, it kind of seemed to spit out a lot of us who were, you know, aggressively anti-narrative because it was destroying the world. But that's when I, and but when I got out of Brown and came back to New York City, that was a really interesting time in New York City, a really interesting time for, you know, for art, for film, for music. And one of the things that was interesting that I think doesn't get talked about that much is it was when MTV started.
Right, early 80s.
And then suddenly there was a need for what were essentially short films, you know?
Experimental, exactly, sometimes.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly.
Well, so you mentioned Todd, and for anyone listening who is living under a rock, Todd is Todd Haynes, who I wonder if you can set this up a little bit, because you guys crossed paths at Brown, but you were apparently it was sort of from afar, and he's told this story about seeing you at an omelet station. So I don't know if you care to share that, and then how you reconnected once you're back in New York afterwards.
Well, we, you know, I think Todd puts it well in the sense that, you know, he took a year off, so he started a year after me. So, and then I went to Paris for a year. And then when I came back, he was going to do his junior. It was a lot of that.
Yes.
We knew a lot of people in common. And for the year that we were both on campus, I did work as a short order cook and, you know, in one of the dining halls. And what he's talking about is, the students would often mix up their eggs and give them to me to scramble or make an omelet. And they were usually in a juice glass. And some student thought it would be funny to give me a glass of orange juice instead. There's nothing like those privileged Ivy League kids who think it's funny to torment somebody who has to actually work their way through college.
Yeah.
So, you know, I had to work really quick, so I just grabbed the glass. And, of course, the whole grill kind of, you know, blew up, ruined everybody else's food. And I just was like, you know what? That's it. You ruined it for everybody. I'm shutting this down. And the kid was like, you can't do that. And I was like, I can, and I did. And then I just said to the rest of the line, closed, sorry, you know, his fault.
Right.
Anyway, so Todd was there for that. And I think he was a little like, wow.
Don't mess with this lady. Yeah. Now, when you both have graduated, apparently you had sort of the coolest job that a person could have in New York in terms of show up but don't work too hard. What was going on was it Cable View Magazine?
It was Cable View Magazine.
Yeah.
Yes. We were proofreaders, and I worked there. Todd worked there. We had lots of, you know, it was basically the job, hire all your friends.
You brought Todd there, or was
I brought Todd there, yes. He didn't stick it out as long as I did, but, you know, he came in and did a few shifts.
But the fact that you even were connected enough to bring him in at that point. You guys had reconnected after graduation?
We had a lot of friends in common in New York, and I think, you know, I don't remember I might be a little off on, but we were starting to see each other a little socially, but not by ourselves. You know, we would in groups.
Yep.
So I was kind of like, anyone who wanted to work at Cableview could. And, you know, our only responsibility truly was making sure that the Cableview magazine that went to Los Feliz was in the right time zone, that the one that went to Seattle was in that time zone. And I can't tell you how many times the boss would come in and be like, okay, so we just sent 20,000 copies of the magazine, you know, to Los Angeles, and it's all in Eastern time. And we'd be like, whoa, that sucks, man.
Now,
it's terrible.
But it was nice because, I guess, were you able to do things with the time that you should have been spending on Cableview? Were you starting to think about work in film? Because I know not that long after, you were an assistant director on some projects. It seems like you were heading down a path towards becoming a director.
Well, I made a couple of short films. But honestly, what really happened was there started to be a little bit more production in New York. Because you have to remember, in those days, New York was not really a production town. There was, and in fact, some of the first jobs I had were on movies that would shoot in L.A. and then come to a day to, you know, so that they could pretend they were in New York.
Right.
That said, at the same time, filmmakers like Jim Jarmusch and Spike Lee and a filmmaker I worked for, Bill Sherwood, were starting to make very personal narrative films that used, for lack of a better word, traditional production. They weren't traditional, but they were telling stories, as opposed to a lot of what you would see at, like, the Anthology or the Collective for Living Cinema, which were often aggressively anti-narrative movies.
And so for Bill Sherwood, we're talking, this is 86, you're an assistant director on a movie, Parting Glances, about gay characters dealing with AIDS at a time. This is early days.
Well, I was actually the assistant editor.
Assistant editor, excuse me, yeah.
And it was about characters dealing with AIDS, but it was also just, it was a story that kind of took place in a gay community in New York City without anybody coming out. So, and because I was the assistant editor, I got to sit and look at everything. And that was an extraordinary experience. Mm-hmm. I really, what I did was I sunk up the dailies, you know, which is now not something anyone has to do.
The fact that, you know, by this point, you and Todd have gotten to know each other a little bit more, right. And it would continue the next year. I know when he did Superstar, and you were not producing, but a sound person, I think, on that one?
I helped him with, well, I should back up a little bit and say, we had one friend in common that we were both pretty close with, and that was a man named Barry Ellsworth.
Yes.
And Barry approached us both and said he wanted to start a production company, and he'd gotten, you know, he came from money, he wanted to know if this was something either of us were interested in. And we were, and we really talked about what we wanted to do. At this point, I'd had enough feature film experience as an assistant director. Ted Hope and I were often up for the same jobs because he was kind of going in that same direction. And I'd line produced, I'd location managed. I understood the mechanics of how a movie got made. So what we decided to do was start a company called Apparatus that would specifically make short films. And it kind of came out of this philosophy of there were grants around at that time, many more than there are now. And filmmakers, people would apply for a grant to make a film, but their knowledge of production was sparse. And often that those were specifically the projects that would just kind of languish and never actually get finished. And we thought, how about we come on and actually be the engine that makes them? And it was kind of a great idea. At the same time, Todd was working on his film, Superstar, the Karen Carpenter story. And, you know, because we were getting closer, he, you know, I went to see it a few times when he was cutting it literally in his apartment on a Steenbeck. So I watched a few versions of it and you know, gave notes. I'm sure my notes were not anything that made any giant difference. But I had also, besides production, I'd had my editing room experience. He was about to do the sound mix, and I had actually prepped movies for sound mixes. So I helped him prep the film for the sound mix.
Got it. And this movie caused a big commotion when it finally was screened.
Yeah,
and still to this day cannot be openly screened, although there are some bootlegs out there, I think. But
there's bootlegs, and it is kind of like whack-a-mole on the, you know, on the internet.
Yes.
It just comes up, somebody takes it down.
Well, one question that I want to bring up, if it's okay, because it's going to sort of preface this genre that you and Todd have both been lumped into forever. So I just wonder, were you always both, I guess I can ask about both of you, but were you guys out to each other in college, like to everyone? Like basically how was it, or is it just purely a coincidence that you ended up both working on a lot of films that had LGBT subject matter in common?
Well, everybody in the 80s in college was bisexual. Everybody was. That just was like, you know.
The thing to do.
Now they're all queer.
Right,
that's a whole other podcast. So Todd was openly gay and had, you know, I knew he had boyfriends. I actually, at the time, I also had boyfriends.
Okay.
I didn't really come out until quite a few years later. By quite a few years, I mean 3 or 4.
Sure.
But that's a lot in, you know, somebody's sexuality time. But also, you have to understand that as we were starting Apparatus and Superstar was gathering steam, because, you know, it went to the Sundance Film Festival when the Sundance Film Festival wasn't called the
U.S. Film Festival.
Yeah, U.S. Right? Film Festival. Yeah. That should be like a Jeopardy.
Yes.
Now, what was this?
Well, also the fact that Poison, which we're going to come to, was the first year it was the Sundance Film Festival.
Is that true?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Wow. So anyway, but we were in the middle of the AIDS crisis.
Right.
So, you know, both of us were very active in ACT UP, and it was a big part of our lives was this, these kind of, these days juxtaposed against you're young, you're in New York, you're, you know, you're partying all night. And then people were just dying. I mean, it was just, but then you would go to ACT UP and there'd be a sense of solidarity and community and a sense of truly righteous anger. It was just a crazy time, you know, but it was, it also kind of forced everybody to have this, like, of course we were all queer, mm-hmm. you know, of course we were all gay,
yeah.
whether you were or you weren't.
Right. So the first time that in terms of your work that would have even been a theme would have been Poison, which
right.
is 1991. And this is now the first time that you are producing for Todd. How did that, did you guys just really click on Superstar or how, because there's now, I guess, something like 4 years between the releases of those two. What was going on in the interim?
Well, we made a number of short films together. Some were more successful than others. One in particular still has sort of a cult following called He Was Once that Mary Hestand directed. So that experience of really being in the trenches with somebody, it was a lot of fun. It was a lot of like, you know, we were very productive. After I saw Superstar, and I did have a kind of epiphany of like, all right, I'm starting to think I know what I want. And what I want is I want to make movies like that. Movies that are incredibly provocative and wholly original, but are entertaining. You know, I could never really brook those anti-narrative movies. And I guess when I saw that, I thought, he's got that voice that I've kind of been looking for. I was starting to think I wanted to produce also for a lot of reasons. I think I didn't have the laser focus that a director has to have. And when I saw, to this day, when I see what Todd brings to the table when he directs, when I was in my semiotics classes at Brown, they're all like, the mise-en-scene, the mise-en-scene. And you're like, uh-huh. And then you understand when you see a master, you understand that every single thing in the frame is about the story and about the character and about what the movie is trying to say. So all to say, I just thought, okay, Todd, I want to make your next movie. And maybe one of my contributions, I feel like there's three contributions I've made to Todd's career that are significant besides, you know, just being by his side. Yeah. One of them was he originally wanted Poison to be an hour long because, you know, he just made a 40-minute movie and it was like each story will be 20 minutes. And I was just getting a sense that there was a whole kind of business world out there and that, you know, I was seeing the fact that like maybe Stranger Than Paradise was already out. And I was like, you know what? Maybe it should be 90 minutes.
Feature length, yeah.
Yes. And that's what it was.
So that's one of the three.
Yes.
I got to get you for what are the other two of the three?
The other one is, I think at a certain point, getting Safe made was so hard and we just kept like getting kicked to the curb and it was a really hard movie to pitch.
I'm going to stop you from going too far because I'm going to hammer it. But that's number two.
Yes.
And what's number three?
Number three is when we finished I'm Not There
yes.
and we were having the what do you want to do next conversation. I was like, you know, I mean, we'd both been obsessed with HBO shows. And right. It's like, you know, maybe you want to think just like we don't have to stay there.
Right.
But maybe let's think about TV a little.
Okay, so we'll come to that too. Yeah. But with Poison, three-part story, and I guess as you mentioned, I think you had alluded to the fact that financing a first feature for him
right.
might not have been easy for any, you know, to finance right. anybody's first feature. So I wonder what that process was like on the level of just getting the money, but also how people were treating you at a time when there were not many female producers in the business.
Well, you know, he got a lot of grants off the strength of Poison. I mean, of Superstar.
Yep.
And we put together a limited partnership, and I worked with two people that were very critical to this. One of them was Lauren Zelaznik, mm-hmm. who went on to run Bravo, et cetera. But she and I produced a few movies together, including Kids. And she had a little bit more, I think, a little bit more business acumen and really was like, okay, this is a path to, you know, potentially attracting investors, et cetera. And we got a few investors. Todd's grandfather invested. So did some family and friends. And, you know, they did get their money back.
Yeah.
So limited partnerships were very popular back in those days. I don't know if they still exist. And then the other person was a good friend of ours from Brown who sadly did die of AIDS, named Brian Greenbaum. And he also just helped helped me think of it as like, this is a business proposal. Like, and it was sort of the beginning of that collision for me of art and commerce. Like, okay, there's a way that you can kind of figure this out. And if you do it right, you get to do what you want.
Right. And in this case, the kind of landmark thing, I guess, correct me if I'm wrong, is that people had not necessarily appreciated or certainly had not capitalized on the fact that there might be a sufficiently sized audience of people in the market to go see a gay-themed film.
Well,
right?
That's it, exactly. I mean, and that, when we took the movie to Sundance, and it won the grand jury prize. And as I should say as an aside, I was a little like, how hard can this be? And of course, I've never won it again, ever. And what have I brought, like 35, 40 movies to Sundance?
We got to have a conversation with Eugene or
I'm
whoever.
I'm a little like, you know, anyway. And then what happened was I think the New York Times wrote an article, you know, Sundance Film Festival, Utah, blah, 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 blah. Grand jury prize, you know, the gay-themed homosexual movie that's also gay, like, you know, wrote something like that.
Well, by the way, also, I think probably noting the gay theme because the best documentary winner that year was Paris is Burning.
That's right. That's right. I forgot they were the same year. That's right.
So that didn't help you guys with your religious right?
Right.
Right. They went nuts because you'd gotten government funding.
They went nuts because we got government funding. And it's catapulted the movie, which we had already had a distribution agreement with Zeitgeist, right? It catapulted it into a whole other stratosphere. And first of all, it was incredible free advertising to the gay and lesbian audience.
Yeah.
But also to other people who are like, ooh, I want to see what's
right.
so disgusting.
Right.
Like, you know, and that really, I thought, wow, you know, if you make a movie and you make it for the right price and then maybe you don't need to break out of the gay audience.
So was it this, I guess, kind of comes back again to this idea of, you know, where people, your next few movies, we've got Swoon, which is
right.
gay themed to the extent that there's the Leopold and Loeb are gay guys who murder people.
Murder a child,
right?
Yes.
Then we've got, and that's 1992. Then we've got Go Fish in 1994.
Right.
Which is the first kind of, I guess, lesbian movie that went big in the way
right.
that did. Then we've got Stonewall in 1995. The fact that you were, as the, you know, these first few movies, both with and without, or with and apart from Todd, mm-hmm. are what come to be labeled by B. Ruby Rich, I guess, first as
right.
new queer cinema. Is that because you'd found that this is a model, an audience that other people are just not tapping into, so I'm going to gravitate towards those projects, or just kind of coincidental?
I think it was a combination. I think that I started to see, like, wow, there is a built-in audience. And, you know, remember at that time, it was very clear how to get to people. It was like there was a gay part of town. There were bars. There were, you know, there was a pride march that had, you know, like when we made Hedwig, Hedwig had a float.
Right.
And so all of those things, I just like, you know, it was very easy to find your audience. I think it was also just what I thought was interesting. And it was opportunity. Like Tom Kalin found out about me because he and Todd were friends. And it was sort of like, you know, that thing you did for Todd, maybe you could do that thing for me too, right. You know? And then Go Fish literally came over the transom, and I asked Tom, because we'd become very close at that point too, to help me, you know, he was from Chicago, they were from Chicago, they were at the Art Institute, there was a lot of commonality. So we really worked together to bring that film to, you know, to where it could go to Sundance.
And then with Stonewall, your director, Nigel Finch,
yeah,
dies of AIDS in the middle of post.
Yeah.
And you basically finished it.
I finished it with the editor and with Nigel's business partner, Anthony Hall, which was really, that was really awful. That was just like, you know, I mean, I guess in retrospect, he got to make the movie and he was, you know, in heaven making that film. And it's such a crazy movie when I see it now. It's just like, what were we thinking?
Well, that same year as Stonewall, there's another movie, which I guess, I don't know if you went into it thinking you might run into some of the similar kind of backlash as like with Poison, but we've got that year Kids,
mm-hmm.
which is Larry Clark's directorial debut,
right.
Harmony Korine's writing debut,
yep.
and a movie that gets an NC-17 from the ratings board, right. but then you guys decide, I guess, to go out without a rating, which some theaters aren't going to put you in because of that and all of that. So all of which is just to ask, and I guess I have to also note, believe it cost you guys $1.5 million, makes $20.4 million. But just as you look back on that one, were you surprised that there was so much backlash? And was the backlash actually... were you finding along the way, you know, as Harvey Weinstein, who
right.
in that case was your partner, often later did, like,
right.
maybe this can actually help the movie?
I mean, I always was of two minds because I, you know, I think Kids is a terrific movie.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's a terrific movie in a way because of, like, a lot of accidents that kind of, like, having us as producers who were really inexperienced. It was me and Lauren Zelaznik did it right. together. Like there's probably things that older, more experienced producers would just not have let happen on that set. That said, I just want to be clear, like that was never an unsafe set.
Right,
and
right.
there was never like, and you know, we were always asked like, are the kids really doing drugs? And Larry, I think would be like, yeah, cause it's real. And it's like, but they weren't,
right.
they weren't. You know? So, but I also think we were trying to create an atmosphere that allowed the sort of a little bit of chaos
right.
that the movie kind of needed, you know, to feel authentic. So Cary Woods had a relationship with Miramax. We sold it to them. We had tried to get Miramax to make it. And, you know, we had like 5 meetings with them and they kept saying they were going to, and then, you know, crickets.
Right.
So Cary sold it to Miramax. I can't remember for how much. I kind of want to say 5.
I have it here as 3.5.
I think it was.
You think
it was
more actually? Yeah.
But anyway, who knows? And then Miramax had just been sold to Disney.
Right.
So they had to start a whole other company to distribute the film.
Because Disney wanted nothing to do with this.
Because of the NC-17.
Yes, yeah.
So they started a company called Shining Excalibur, and it was actually Eamon Bowles who distributed the film. And I'm sure they absolutely leaned into the controversy and liked that, wouldn't necessarily Not that anyone was interested in what I or Lauren Zelaznik had to say, but they wouldn't necessarily want us to be there saying, oh, no, the set was really safe. Da-da-da-da-da. You know, they probably didn't mind that there was some sense that,
sure,
that you know, it was cinema verite.
Now, looking back, the third movie that year, which you referenced a little earlier, your third movie that year was Safe, which it had been 4 years since Poison for Tommy.
Right.
I guess part A, that long of a gap after a successful first feature, was that, what was that about? And then part B, even after you guys had Julianne Moore on board, who was sort of becoming a name, and you know, other pieces of the puzzle, including this script, which today is, the film's looked at as this classic, but it was a up and uphill climb, wasn't it?
It was crazy. I mean, I think, well, two things. One is Todd did do, in between Poison and Safe, he made a terrific short film called Dottie Gets Spanked, which was made with money from an independent television, public television company called ITVS. And he also did a music video for Sonic Youth. So just, he was not completely inactive. Yeah. And Dottie was kind of a good stepping stool because it was, we cast, you know, for the lack of a better word, like real actors, you know. Mm-hmm. He went through a casting process with a real casting director that was very different from what he had done on Poison, which was much more like, let's put an ad in Backstage and see who shows up. And, you know, oh, and this friend of ours would be really good in this part, right, et cetera. So, you know, Dottie, we went through a whole process. We found a little boy, all of that. I think Safe, I think he was telling, he was doing something very, very different. And I think, you know, I remember sometimes we'd go and talk to executives and he would say, you know, the biggest influence on this movie is Chantal Ackerman's movie, Jean Dielman. And I would be like, oh, God. And I think either the executive has absolutely no clue what he's talking about 90%
right,
of the time.
Right.
They'd be like, oh, yeah, so one of my favorites, you know, whatever. Or they'd be like, that 3.5 hour long movie where nothing happened.
Not going to sell, yeah.
So there was, you know, there was that. We finally pieced together the budget with some pre-sales, an investment from John Hart, who I then went on to make Boys Don't Cry with, and some other titles. I think Todd's grandfather put some money in as well, so we sort of like cobbled it together.
Yeah.
And Julianne, you know, she had just kind of come out of the soaps. She had done the Altman movie, but it wasn't out yet.
Shortcuts, right? Yeah.
Shortcuts, and she did The Hand That Rocks the Cradle.
Right. So, meanwhile, even after you get the money and you get going, you run into the earthquake, you run into everything that can happen. Goes to Sundance and Cannes, not particularly well received.
No. And the other thing I just want to say is just the idea of attaching cast to get financing, that was new to me.
Okay.
That was the first, like, oh, this is how we have to do it now? Okay. And I remember Julianne's manager, who is still her manager, Evelyn O'Neill, like, you know, yelling at me on the phone and saying, like, you know, she has to, and I was like, okay, like, who is this person?
Right,
and do I have to deal with these people now for the rest of my life who are, like, yelling at me because, you know, and she, one of the things she said is, and I assume she's pay or play. And I was like, sure. I had no idea what she was talking about.
Well, you had many more dealings with her and Evelyn since
then. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
So Killer Films is your production company. I believe right about that same time, 95, 96, is when this comes to fruition. How did you and your partner in that, Pamela Koffler, first meet? And why did you decide to form this and call it Killer Films?
Well, Pam had worked as a line producer on a number of our films, Kids, I Shot Andy Warhol, and Stonewall. And when I came back from Los Angeles doing Safe, that's when we started, I think, those three movies. And that allowed us, because it was three movies, one right after the other, and we stayed in the same production office, that allowed us to actually start, get a little security and start talking about development. Mm-hmm. And, you know, even though we didn't make Boys Don't Cry for like another 6 or 7 years, it came through our doors at that time. Mm-hmm. So one thing we started developing was a horror movie for Cindy Sherman, the artist, to direct called Office Killer. Mm-hmm. And that was when I kind of formally asked Pam if she would partner with me. Yeah. And she really took a chance, you know? It was kind of like she could make, you know, she could have been on a trajectory of, like, becoming, like, a very well-paid line producer with real job security, you know? And
that was never of great appeal to you?
I'm a terrible line producer.
Well, no. I don't even mean necessarily a lot, but like
I could
doing
have been
more
an,
studio.
I could have been an assistant director. Yeah. I was really good at that.
Okay.
But I would probably be dead of a heart attack by now. But I was good at it. But, you know, we were just at the right age. You know, I was probably 30. She's a few years younger than me. And I think it felt like it's now or never. And it didn't feel so much like, all right, here we go. It felt more like we really like doing this. We like doing this together. Let's try and make it work.
So was there a mission statement from the beginning about this is what a killer film Mm-mm. will be? Any kind of limitations or goals or anything like that?
I mean, it sounds silly, but it really is like we know what we like. And, you know, Pam and I are very different. You know, she's not gay. People who meet her might think she's more conservative than I am. I think that's just, you know, maybe how she presents. But I think she has extraordinary taste, and it's different from mine. And that's a good thing. So it means that we have a lot to talk about.
Yeah.
You know, when she loves a script and I don't love it, I always understand why she does, and vice versa.
And what happens when you disagree?
Oh, it's more like, you know, if you really love this, let's do it, you know? We don't really disagree. We it's more like after so many years, it's kind of like we figured out there's a certain kind of crazy I can handle and a certain kind of crazy she can handle.
Right.
And it kind of just divides up, you know, where she'll be like, you got to call that person. And I'm like, I got it. Right. Or I'll be like, you know, I'm never speaking to him again. And she'll be like, I'm on top of it. Don't worry.
Well, so after, I guess you said I Shot on Andy Warhol was before the partnership formally.
Yes.
After the partnership, there start to be a number of movies that I've got to ask you just about something crazy that happened. And by the way, I'll reiterate to listeners that they can get a lot more of this in your two great memoirs, one of which was just chosen as one of the 100 greatest film books of all time. But let me just tee up, first of all, your next movie with Todd in 1998, back, I believe, with the good old Weinsteins, was Velvet Goldmine,
mm-hmm.
Kind of an epic about glam rock, the
yep.
whole scene there, but a very tumultuous one from what I understand for you guys. What went wrong there, but it sounds like very little went according to plan.
Well, it did and it didn't. I mean, I think it was like almost all of Todd's movies at that time were incredibly ambitious, and you know, the ambition was much bigger than our means. So with Velvet Goldmine, a lot went right. I mean, Ewan McGregor was arguably at the time, you know, the hottest young star. He was fresh off of Trainspotting, and he wanted to do it. Toni Collette had just done Muriel's Wedding, and she wanted to do it. Christian Bale, who nobody had heard of, had become, actually, the first internet star. You know, it was because I think of Newsies, right. And the internet was still a relatively new thing. This giant fan base kind of mobilized around him. And Jonathan Rhys-Meyers was also the start of what everyone thought was going to be a meteoric rise. So we got this extraordinary cast. The tough part was, you know, being in a country we didn't really understand, and, you know, being told a lot, oh, we don't do it that way. Or we're probably told, we don't do it that way, you know.
But you lose $1 million right before it starts.
We did,
from
yes.
the budget. Like, yeah. This is the kind of stuff that people who, you know, oh, they may not wonder. God. Yeah, that little thing. But, like, that falls on the producer, right? You better recalibrate everything.
But you have to recalibrate everything. But the only way you can do it, and I remember this really clearly, is Todd and I went out to dinner. And I was like, this is going to be really, really tough. And I need to know that you want to do it. Because we could stop right now. You don't have to make this movie. And if you think it's just going to be too hard or too, or just like not be the movie you want it to be, we can just all go home, you know, and it's done. And he was like, I do really want to do it. And then it was like, okay. And then the work wasn't so hard. It was tough decisions, but it wasn't like we were at odds with each other. It was like, all right, we can have this or we can have that. You know, this is, we can have this kind of a solution or that kind of a solution.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
But then you have to give up something. You know, it was like that.
Okay, the next one also that year, Todd Solondz's Happiness, which, okay, so I don't even know what a log line would be for this movie. It's an eccentric movie from an eccentric filmmaker. Your movie goes to Cannes, director's fortnight, people rave. This is at that point with October Films, a division
Correct.
Of Universal.
No, it wasn't yet.
Not yet a division.
It had just become a division. Become.
Okay, so among the glowing write-ups.
Right.
I regret to report, because I believe that this was long before my time here,
it was
The Hollywood Reporter.
It was The Hollywood Reporter.
Now, what happened that made your life a bit complicated there?
So, a Hollywood Reporter, who I didn't speak to for years afterwards, although, in all fairness, it probably wasn't really his fault.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't think he set out to do what this, you know. But Universal had just bought October, or reasonably recently. And in the sort of wrap-up of the festival, this reporter mused, I wonder what Edgar Bronfman thinks about the fact that October Films, a subsidiary, is about to release a movie that is a sympathetic portrayal of a pedophile. And that was like, boom! And then Bingham Ray reached out to us and said, I can't distribute the movie anymore, and you can't sell it to anybody else.
He can't distribute it, not because he doesn't want to, but because he's getting it from Universal.
Exactly. And so we ended up, Good Machine was handling the foreign sales. That was David Lindy, Ted Hopes, and James Shamus's company that then went on to essentially become Focus. They were like, all right, well, we're going to have to put together a distribution team to distribute it ourselves. And, you know, they had somebody they were interested in working with. And I was feeling a little like, oh, I want to make sure, I want to protect Killer and I want to protect, I'm not saying they made a bad decision at all, but I only knew one person in distribution. And that person was the person who had kind of taken over I Shot Andy Warhol when I Shot Andy Warhol, you know, had been the Samuel Goldwyn company, you know, companies, and it ended up, I guess, at UA. And the guy who just inherited it was a great guy, and I really loved working with him, and it was Bob Burney.
Okay.
And so I said to David and James and Ted, I want that guy. I want Bob Burney. And Bob came on, and I think really, like, elevated the distribution as on a very limited budget, et cetera, et cetera. And I think really saved the film from obscurity.
Next year is Boys Don't Cry.
Yeah.
Which I believe was originally called Take It Like a Man during the many years you were in development.
It was called Take It Like a Man. And I think Fine Line had bought Boy George's biography, autobiography,
That's
which
why
was
it
called
changed.
Take It Like a Man.
Okay.
And I could tell they were never going to make that movie. And they called and they were like, you know, you're sending a cease and desist. And I was like, you're really going to make me change the title?
After all these years.
You losers.
Of work. Right.
You know? And then we had to change the title. And of course, no one can imagine it now being called anything else.
No.
But
now, when you, so it was always Kimberly Pierce. She
yes.
was at Columbia when you got involved with?
So, you know, a good 6 or 7 years before we made the movie. Rose Trochet, who did Go Fish, said to me, oh, and this story, remember, this was pre-internet, or if it was early internet.
Yeah.
So there were a couple of articles that had come out about Brandon Tina. One was in Playboy, of all things, and the Village Voice did one. And there was a lot of, like, did you hear about, you know, this... I don't even know if trans was in our vocabulary, you know, and they pretended that they were a boy and it was in the towns. It was almost Shakespearean in its sort of scope. And Rose said, you know, that story. Well, there's this woman, Kim Pierce, and I've met her a couple times and she's really smart. Can she come show you her student film? So she came and talked to us about the story, and she didn't have her student film because it was at Duart and she owed like $2,000. And I actually paid it.
Oh my gosh.
I know, and it's not like I had $2,000. But, and we looked at it.
Yeah.
And it was fine. It didn't necessarily say, oh my God, this is an auteur who's, but her passion and ability to talk about what she wanted to do was clear. She cut together some of the short film and we started showing it to people potentially as, you know, something that they would invest in to be made into a longer film, which was still something people did.
Like proof of concept, yeah.
Yes. And I think people were a little tripped up by the lead performance because it wasn't completely convincing. And then the Killers, who hadn't even gone to trial yet, they went to trial, and Kim went to Nebraska and sat in on the trials, got to know more and more people in Brandon's life, and came back with a much richer take and script and started working with Andy Beenan. And anyway, the script we eventually shot was pretty far from the one that she had brought to us, which we still liked enough to want to do.
Now, you know— obviously, this is almost 25-year-old ancient history
right.
with what I'm going to ask you. But so there were all these reports that Kimberly was bucking heads with Hillary Swank, whatever. Here we are, though. The point is just actually, obviously, Hillary Swank wins Best
right.
Actress Oscar. And I just had an episode a couple weeks ago with Alexander Payne, and he had this thing, and he cited Boys Don't Cry as an example where he believes that first film of many talented filmmakers, they're so passionate about it. It's like their one thing that they're
yes.
living for, that it's not a coincidence that draws a talented actress. Not that Hillary Swank was a huge star yet, but it draws
right.
top talent, often results in an Oscar like that one did.
Right.
I guess I just wonder, because you are so often have chosen to work with first-time filmmakers, is the thing that draws you to them and to Kimberly in this case, that there is something different on that first project than when the next thing, like, what is it?
It's pretty much what Alexander said, which is a first-time filmmaker is usually telling that story they've been waiting their whole life to tell. And it's almost like there's something about that that prevents cynicism. And I think cynicism is so hard to avoid in this business because it's just like, why wouldn't you be cynical?
Yeah, yeah.
But it also destroys any pleasure and ability to, I think, be truly creative. So in some ways, I need to do the first-time filmmakers' movies as like my inoculation.
Yes.
You know?
Well, so Boys Don't Cry, you've said that's the one that sort of really put killer films on the map. Then not that long after, you have 1 Hour Photo, Mark Romanek,
right.
which I think was your biggest success to that point commercially.
Yes.
And then we get to Far From Heaven, which I love all of Todd and your movies, but there I have a very special place for that one. And yet I was kind of amazed to learn that for you, it was, it, you know, there were some major frustrations, I guess, particularly towards the end. What was, from your experience with Far From Heaven, why was that rocky?
Well, okay, we made Far From Heaven literally the month after 9/11. So the actual sort of ramp up to starting to get, you know, to the financing was difficult, but it wasn't the worst. We, you know, it came together the way it should have. And then the world went berserk. We lost some of our financing right a few days before 9/11. And I'd come back from the Toronto Film Festival and realized that the only way I could put the movie back together again was to go back to Toronto. And at that time, our U.S. partner was USA Films, which was formerly October Films.
And so, it would become Focus.
Who then became Focus.
Yeah.
But this was Scott Greenstein.
Okay.
So there was that little vacation that between October and Focus
right.
that was USA
yeah,
Films.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So they were cash flowing the movie, but they were also threatening me that unless we fixed this financial hole that we suddenly had, they were going to stop. So I went to Toronto with like a gun to my head, and John Sloss and I, you know, we were trying to nail down this French distributor. It's a long, you know, long, boring story. And then we wake up the next morning and the towers are falling down. And, it was insane. The crew was all like, we still want to shoot this movie. Like, everyone wanted to get back to normal. But part of what made the movie go berserk was the insurance business went insane. So who bonds a movie? An insurance company. So that kind of fear of disaster, the risk adversity, I mean, Julianne Moore was pregnant, and I found out and told, you know, told the insurers after 9/11, and they went crazy and basically treated it as if she had leprosy. Jeez. And, you know, wanted some giant deductible, but everything was like that.
And was it, though, they actually, and I can't imagine this has happened to you more often than just this once, but at the last week or so, was it, they literally essentially took over the film?
Yes, but I mean, just to show you how crazy it was, the bond rep said to me at one point, you have to prevent Dennis Quaid from going back to Los Angeles for Thanksgiving. And I was like, what are you talking about? Like, his family's in Thanksgiving in Los yeah. Angeles. Like, why wouldn't he go back? And she said, well, if there's another terrorist attack, he may not want to come back to New York. And I was like, okay, there are so many things wrong with
yeah,
that sentence.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But that just shows you where people's brains
yeah.
were.
So I guess that Far From Heaven story shows you that it's sort of, it's like with the, you read about the making of Casablanca, so
right.
it's like everything that went wrong could have gone wrong and you still end up with a great movie. So I don't know what the lesson there is. But after that, you've got Altman and the Company, Robert Altman's The Company, 2003.
Right.
You got John Waters' Dirty Shame, 2004. And then we come to a situation where, again, I'm just kind of bringing up some of these so people can understand the type of shit that you have to deal with as a producer sometimes. And what are you supposed to do in the case of, in 2006, you have the movie Infamous, which unfortunately
right.
is the exact same time, basically coming along at the same time as Bennett Miller's Capote.
Yeah.
And how does that, what is your thought process in that situation? What can you control? What can't you control?
I mean, at that point, that movie was set up, Infamous was set up with Warner Independent, Mark Gill's company at the time. So all I could, you know, so we were financed, and it was really about, you know, I think really who got there first, and we didn't get there first. That said, you know, the late Doug McGrath, who, you know, was a very close friend, I think Infamous is a terrific film. And when it came out and it didn't really get its due, I said to Doug, Doug, I am so sorry. I am so sorry that you made this extraordinary movie and that it's not really going to get the acclaim it so deserves. And he said, are you kidding? We got to make the movie. That other movie, you know, I know that's a drag, but I got to make my movie and I got to make it the way I wanted to.
That's nice.
So, you know, that's one way to look at it.
There you go. The year after that, back with Todd, I'm Not There, which I believe you have said, and understandably enough, was one of the harder sells.
That was a fucking nightmare.
Let's just to establish five different time periods, seven different major actors asking for $18 million in financing.
Yeah.
Right? What was the response from people when you took that to them?
I mean, honestly, at that point, my ignorance about cast and how it drove financing was long gone.
Yeah.
So, you know, Todd's stroke of genius really was casting Cate Blanchett. But, you know, everybody, at that point, everybody wanted to be in a Todd Haynes movie. Yes. So the financing wasn't so difficult. I think what was more difficult was $18 million wasn't really enough, you know? And I say that with a full understanding that, you know, movies have to be made for the market, and that's, and sometimes doesn't matter what you think, you know.
Right.
Sometimes a director will say to me, yeah, I think this really wants to be a $20 million movie. And I'm like, well,
good luck,
you know, the problem is the market says it should be 10.
Right.
So, but it was so ambitious and all those different time periods. It just was, and, you know, we were shooting in unfamiliar territory. You know, that was shooting in Canada with a Canadian crew. And it was really, really tough.
But as you say, Cate Blanchett, so good in that. And a lot of people, it was just...
She was great. Heath Ledger was amazing. Christian Bale.
Yeah.
I mean, it was a terrific cast.
Sure. So the next time you and Todd work together is what you referenced as your third of your three big achievements with him. And I think that's undercounting, but nevertheless, this is Mildred Pierce, which you're doing for HBO back in 2011, before it became the cool thing to go and do, film people to go and do TV. This is you, Todd, Kate Winslet, and it really did change things. Can you just talk about, what was the conversation that you were having internally and with your collaborators in terms of calculating whether or not it was actually a smart thing to go and do TV with somebody of the people of those caliber?
Well, you know, Todd and I had the TV discussion. And then like a couple weeks later, he came back to me and he said, I know what it should be. He said, have you read the book, Mildred Pierce? And I said, no, I've seen the movie. And he said, well, the book is actually not a film noir, you know, and it's very different from the movie. And there's something so inherently domestic about it. It's like, I think it should be in your living room. He said, read the book this weekend. So I started reading the book, which is actually pretty slim. And about midway through the weekend, Todd texted me or called me. I don't even know if we were texting back in those days. And said, so what do you think? And I said, it's great, but when does the murder happen? And he's like, ugh, there is no murder. That's the point. That's the whole point. And I was like, okay. Because, of course, you know, the movie famously starts with the murder.
Yep.
So then we attached. Now, at that time, of course, on the movies, we were attaching actors and et cetera, as we just talked about on I'm Not There. Attaching actors in television wasn't really a thing. And we walked into HBO and basically said, so here's all the scripts. They're all written because he had already written them with John Raymond.
Right.
So here's, you know, 5 or 6 hours of television. Kate Winslet is attached. And HBO was like, wait, no. That's not how we do things. And I was like, she's available in the spring.
Yeah.
So let us know if you want to do it or not. And now, of course, that's how we do it.
Yeah.
But at the time, it was really
and was working in long form TV any different to you than making just a long movie?
No. And I have to say, HBO, they were extraordinary partners. I mean, the culture there was so artist friendly, and we just cross-boarded it like a really long film, and it was, you know, it was a marathon, especially, you know, for Todd and Kate, you know, who were, you know, because Kate was in, like, you know, Kate had to miss one day of work because of food poisoning, and we were like, there's nothing really to shoot. Nothing really to do. Okay.
Well, amazing. And it really has made long-form TV the place for a lot of people. But last two case studies before we get to this amazing 2023 of yours. Still Alice, 2014. You have said that that's the movie that put your daughter through college.
Well, I actually said that on a panel in Glasgow where I was not told there'd be any press.
Oh, okay.
So I was a little like, oh.
Well, but I mean, it's really interesting because I think about these movies that we've been talking about. Many of them are now, you know, considered classics.
Right.
They seem to have not lost money. So how is it that Still Alice is the one that you sort of personally reap the most out of?
I mean, there's a lot of answers to that question. A lot of it has to do with how much ownership you can maintain over a movie and its revenue stream. And sometimes you have to give away a lot in order to get it made. And, you know, our movies don't usually lose money. And they don't usually lose money because we have a real sense of, like, what the market can bear. But with Still Alice, I think it was just the way it was put together. An honest company, Sony Pictures Classics,
right,
which is, you know, I mean, because as you said, something you referenced, oh, kids made $20 million. Yeah, you think I ever saw any of that? Party,
Harvey.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. When you work with, you know, good partners and a movie really does perform, then that is what should happen.
And you really, I mean, the thread there is, I imagine you helped to bring Julianne Moore to these filmmakers who she would not necessarily have known.
That's true. And also I think we gave Julianne a comfort level that even though it was a low budget movie, you know, it wasn't going to be a shit show.
No, she only won an Oscar for it. So that was,
but I think for a lot of actors, I feel like a lot of them, they're open to doing crazy indie movies with first time directors. What they don't want is they get there and they can't get onto the location or, you know, the holding area has no bathroom or any of those things that are just like, you know, so I get that.
It worked out. Well, I'm glad you guys made a few bucks there. Carol, 2015, Todd and you again. And again, it shows, I guess, what a business of relationships this is, right? Because this originates because you have a history with some folks who had a production company who owned the rights, or just how does that happen there?
So Carol is distinctive because, for a lot of reasons, but one of the reasons is it's the first time Todd did a script he didn't write himself. And I am very good old friends with a woman named Elizabeth Carlson, who's married to a man named Steve Woolley, and they have a company called Number Nine. They used to run Palace Pictures. They made movies like The Crying Game. And Carol, a script of Carol had sort of been bouncing around for some time. I remember it sort of coming across our desk a time or two, like for Rose. I think it might have come once for Kim Pierce. And whoever had those rights then, they lapsed. And Liz Carlson made it hurt. She was like, I'm gonna get them and I'm gonna get this movie made. And I think she had to convince the estate because, you know, they'd seen the movie, seen it like not get made for so long. Right. Like, why are you different? But she did. And then it was just one of those kind of crazy things where she had a director attached. I had actually heard a rumor that director was going to step down because of some family issues. And we would speak every few weeks just about our lives, about our kids, whatever.
You and the filmmaker.
Me and Liz.
Okay.
Todd had a movie that he was trying to get into production, but it just was like, it kind of wasn't clicking into place. And Liz and I got on the phone and she said, all right, you were right. Like, filmmaker stepped down. And it's just like, oh, I don't know what to do. And I said, yeah, you know, Todd's movie looks like it's not happening either. And then we really had this eureka moment. And one of us said, let's show it to Todd.
It seems like it was made for him, right?
So we gave it to him on a Friday, and he was committed on the Monday.
Amazing. And there are a lot of people who feel that's the best of all the Todd Christine collaborations.
Wait till they see May, September.
Exactly. Well, that's right.
May, December.
Well, exactly. Okay. So just, you know, there's so many others we could talk about. You win Sundance documentary, not the Dinah 2017. We've got you and Todd again with Wonderstruck in 2017, you and Paul Schrader, First Reform 2017, you and Todd, Dark Waters 2019, Zola 2020, The Velvet Underground with Todd 2021, great documentary. And here we are in 2023, another one of these years where you've got multiple amazing projects, which is hard enough to get one. But chronologically, I guess the first one that the public saw would have been Past Lives, Celine Song, who had been and remains a very admired playwright, but yes, for like a decade, but had never written or directed a feature film before. So how, just again, it kind of comes back to what we were talking about earlier, but how does a first-time filmmaker or aspiring first-time filmmaker convince Christine Vachon to make time for them and their work?
Well, this one actually, A24 was already on it, and they reached out to us and asked us if we would sit down with her. And during the pandemic, Pam had called a number of agents and said, just send me your best script. Like, it doesn't have to be available. I just want to read, like, really great scripts. And one of them was Past Lives. And I remember Pam saying, oh, boy, like, this one, I so wish we had a crack at this because it's really, really good. So when it turned out it did need a producer, sitting down with Celine, really, you know, at the end of the day, it's all about, do they know the story they want to tell? And if they do, everything else you can kind of like, I mean, she doesn't know how to read a call sheet. She can learn how to read a call sheet in 5 minutes. Like, see, there's the actors.
Right.
There's their times.
Right.
This is all the other shit you need, you know? And then, oh, I get it. Okay. You know, that's easy. Understanding, like, how to talk to a DP, all of that is much easier than really understanding your story. And she really did. I think part, you know, we wanted to make sure that she was surrounded by people who were value added, who could really help her, you know, navigate every, you know, all those potential like pitfalls. But, you know, she was wonderful with the actors. And she, look, she told it beautifully.
Oh, it's great. And I just don't know. You guys, to do a multi-language project largely abroad in South Korea.
Well, only 2 weeks in South
Korea.
2 weeks,
partly abroad. Yeah. And during COVID.
Right.
It can never, it's never easy.
Right. But,
okay, and then go to Cannes in May, and there's May, December, which in this case, you are, and Killer is producing with Natalie and Sophie Moss, who I guess initially reached out to you guys.
So Sammy wrote the script, and it was actually Jessica Elbaum who saw it first.
Okay.
Jessica Elbaum works with Will Ferrell at Gloria Sanchez, and she sent it to Natalie, potentially for Natalie to direct. And Natalie apparently said, you know, this is an amazing script, and I want to be Elizabeth, but I don't want to direct. Let's send it to Todd Haynes. So we get a lot of stuff for Todd. And, you know, I tell him about everything. And, you know, usually I'm like, look, you should make your own decision. This one's about X, Y, or Z. Do you want to read it? Do you want coverage? Whatever. Pam and I read this and we were both like, oh, he's going to want to talk about this. And I think the fact that Natalie was attached was obviously a big part of it, because then he could start to see And he immediately was like, I'm sending this to Julianne.
Yes, yeah.
So that was kind of, you know, that just was sort of perfect.
And the, I heard that you and Pam had a nickname for it.
Oh, what? Are you talking about pedophile Barbie?
Yes.
See, I'm not supposed to say that. That was like a...
Well, I mean, you know, hey, it's what it's about.
Yeah.
And became a huge thing. I think the biggest sale out of Cannes this year. Big deal.
I mean, you know, our Cannes was sort of a comedy, too, because Julie was in the middle of shooting something and was only available for one night. And, you know, she really wanted to be there. We really wanted her there. But it meant we had to follow the Scorsese film.
Which 3.5 hours.
3.5 hours. And it was pouring rain.
I will admit, I was at the second screening.
You know, so I was just like, I was like, oh, my God.
Yeah, not ideal.
But, you know.
It worked out.
It worked out. They were all there. The screening. People were, I think it was very different from Killers of the Flower Moon.
Yes, yes, good counter programming.
And, you know, it was really just, it was a great evening, regardless.
Last minute here, just sort of a rapid fire, what comes to your mind if we can? Why are you still based in New York rather than LA?
I don't know how to drive.
Good reason. Do you still, you know, really consider a first-time filmmakers more, like, has your desire to work with first-time filmmakers lessened as you've, you know, gathered experience and just time in the business?
It hasn't really lessened. It's more that I have to be practical and pragmatic about my company's resources and how to allot them, basically.
Are streamers net-net good or bad for film?
It's a complicated question because these days, sometimes I ask my students, like, define a film.
Right.
And they, I mean, sometimes I'm like, these 3.5-hour movies all these boys are making, those are miniseries.
Right, you know? Right, right.
So what, you know, is it just about a theatrical experience or is it about, to me, a movie is one of those, is a under 2-hour experience that has a universal idea, you know, that could be small in scope and scale, but there's something about it that touches everybody.
What is the producer's equivalent of selling out and why haven't you done it?
I don't know if I haven't done it.
Is there anything you look at, you know, some of these guys that are doing, let's say, Marvel movies or whatever, and they probably all, there's certain accoutrement or whatever, anything that's...
I mean, if I got asked to do a Marvel movie under the right circumstances, I'd do it.
I don't know.
Sure. I mean, if it was a great script with a great director, why wouldn't I? You know?
I hope they're listening. We've
worked with, you know, the whole idea of what's independent and what isn't. I mean, back in the day, it was easy, right. You know? I did a interview a million years ago with Larry Gordon.
Yeah.
Like, they did a interview with both of us.
I remember reading it
It was kind of funny. And he had just done Waterworld.
Yep.
And he was a little like, and you're what? Exactly. Like, no, he was great, but he was just a little like, what do you do?
It's hard to process.
But he said something really interesting. He said, I just thought an independent film was a movie you took to market. And I was like, kinda is.
Yes. Oh, the lines have blurred, I guess.
And now it's like, how is, you know, we work with all the studios. We work with every major financier, every major, foreign sales company, you know. We work with the banks. We work with, I mean,
yeah, when
who
they
we
talk
not work with?
And the whole thing, like Harvey era Miramax being independent, as you said, they were part of Disney.
Exactly.
Last question. It is considered by any film aficionados to be a travesty that somehow, after all the things we have talked about, you have not yet received a nomination for an Oscar, meaning one of your films being nominated for Best Picture. Does that, if we gave you truth serum, does that bother you, and what would one, you've got two great shots this year, what would it mean to get one?
I mean, I'm not, it doesn't keep me up at night.
Right.
But, I mean, I'm not going to pretend I wouldn't love it. I mean, I think anybody who says that they wouldn't is, you know, is kidding themselves.
Right.
And I mean, I've been lucky enough over the years to have gone on the trajectory a few times without being nominated, but, you know, being in the discussion. And I know, you know, when I talk to people sometimes and they're like, oh, another boring dinner or whatever, I'm just like, do you hear yourself? Like, it's so hard. It's hard to get the movie made. And then it's hard to make it well. And then the critics have to like it. The audience has to like it. And sometimes you just get one. And then people have to want to see it. And when all of those things line up and suddenly people are putting your movie on a list, I mean, that's fantastic. And it's often a once-in-a-lifetime experience. I mean, for me, it's maybe been 3 times, 4 times. That's it.
Far From Heaven, Carol.
Boys Don't Cry.
Boys Don't Cry.
And I guess right now
we got two.
Yeah. So, you know, so I know not to be cynical about it and just to enjoy it as it comes. And I'm in my nice hotel and we're junket is happening and the actors are here and it's great. Of course I would love it. But I don't, it's like, it's not why we do it.
No, of course.
And I also know at some point, you know, I think as I've said, I might just get the Irving Thalberg and I'll gum my...
Well,
my,
they're not mutually exclusive.
That's
if these
true.
Guys can't get it together, that they
then
should do that,
I'll
but you
just,
keep going.
I'll get wheeled out and and the audience will be like, who's that again?
Oh, my God. Well,
so, oh, and you don't even get to be anymore part of the
no, it's
ceremony.
Their own thing to go.
It's its own thing. But at least you get a statue.
You get something, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you're the best. Thank you so much for doing
this. My
pleasure. Appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Awards Chatter. We really appreciate it and would really appreciate you taking just a minute more to subscribe to the podcast and to leave us a rating and review on your podcast app. And to follow us on Twitter and Instagram, where our handle is @AwardsChatter. On those platforms, we announce upcoming guests and provide details about special live recordings of the podcast that you can attend. Until next time, thanks again for tuning in.